So I always tell people, it's like, oh, you know, Gary hit rock bottom. Every time I hit rock bottom, I had dynamite in my pocket. You know, there's always another bottom, I think, until you're gone. I came home in April of 2021 after 8 months in treatment. I locked myself in my room for 3 days because I was scared to leave. I didn't go to a meeting, didn't talk with anyone, just tried to white knuckle it. And the first place I went was to get a pack of cigarettes 3 days later. And the first person I saw was a dude I used to get high with. And as soon as he asked me, I said, yes. I was on a bender for a few days. I went from meth to heroin to fentanyl within 30 minutes of each other. And 3 days later, I'm dead. Overdosed again in a hospital. If there's a place called hell and a place called heaven, I truly believe that I was on my way to hell.
Welcome to Curious Goldfish, a podcast community where music and curiosity come together through interesting conversations with the music makers of our world. I'm your host, Jason English. You can find Curious Goldfish in all the major podcast and social media platforms. And of course, we have all of our content on our website, CuriousGoldfish.com. We all, at one point or another in our lives, experience setback, challenge, loss, grief, or struggle. These periods are sometimes referred to as valleys or deserts, where you just can't seem to find water, and the way up to the mountaintop seems impossible. Ted Lasso, the main character in the television series Ted Lasso, is a fictional soccer coach. Demonstrating empathetic leadership during an extended winless streak, Coach Lasso compared these seasons of struggle to a dark forest.
Listen, yeah. I don't care what our record is, but I hear the chatter, people saying there's something wrong with us. Not the way I see it, okay? Now, these next few months might be tricky, but that's just because we're going through our dark forest. Fairy tales do not start, nor do they end, in the dark forest. That son of a gun always shows up smack dab in the middle of a story. But it will all work out. Now, it may not work out how you think it will, or how you hope it does, but believe me, it will all work out.
Few people have experienced a forest as dark as what musician Gary Nichols has. Even after Gary found himself on top of a mountain, when he and his band The Steel Drivers won a Grammy for their bluegrass album The Muscle Shoals Recordings 7 years ago. In my conversation with him for the podcast, Gary talks about how his dark forest kept getting darker and darker as a result of severe addiction to heroin and other lethal drugs. Imagine being approached by a successful band to replace Chris Stapleton as its lead singer. Imagine winning a Grammy with that band on your second album after it was recorded in and named after your hometown of legendary Muscle Shoals, Alabama. Imagine being on the verge of financial freedom and fame only to lose it all while destroying nearly all of the meaningful relationships around you, almost dying and serving time in prison to boot. That was Gary Nichols' dark forest. But as Ted Lasso asserts, fairy tales don't begin nor do they end in a dark forest. For Gary, the shimmer of light through the branches came through watching, in a jail cell of all places, a remake of a classic music film starring Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga called A Star Is Born. You might have seen it.
Tell me something, boy. Aren't you tired trying to fill that void? Or do you need more? Ain't it hard keeping it so hardcore?
Is that me?
That's you.
You just write that now?
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
Lady Gaga sings about keeping it hardcore. And that about sums up Gary Nichols' journey through the dark forest. But thanks to a viewing of A Star Is Born while in jail, and thanks to an incredible support system at Ivy Manor at the Shoals, an all-inclusive recording studio in Sheffield, Alabama, Gary is making his way out of the forest. On a sun-bathed spring day, Gary talks about this journey in incredible, intimate detail. He talks about his hometown and talks about his plans to release new music later this year. He also sings two new songs. First, one of hope and inspiration called Learning How to Walk Again, a brilliant analogy to him starting over with baby steps on his road to recovery from addiction. The second song is absolutely incredible. It's called The Devil's Blood. It's a step-by-step analysis of shooting up and the lessons learned that people of all ages and backgrounds should heed with every note and lyric. Gary might be the most talented musician I've ever spent time with, and it's still incredibly sad he almost threw it all away. I can only pray that blue skies are ahead for him and his family, and the world is ready to welcome him back for his new chapter. You might say he is a star reborn. Here's Gary Nichols of Muscle Shoals, Alabama. Let's dive in. Hey, Gary. So nice to meet you.
Hey, Jay. It's good to meet you as well.
I appreciate your time. We're here at Ivy Manor. Outside of Ivy Manor here in Muscle Shoals, Alabama.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful day, spring.
Gorgeous. Perfect day, actually.
Yeah. You're from here.
Born and raised. Born just about a mile and a half down the road at Helen Keller Hospital, and spent most of my life in Florence, which is part of the Quad Cities that make up the area that everyone calls Muscle Shoals.
Yeah. So Muscle Shoals is famous now for a lot of the music stuff, but I didn't realize Helen Keller was from here.
Sure, yeah. Helen Keller, W.C. Handy, Sam Phillips, who was, you know...
Memphis
discovered Elvis and Johnny Cash and Jerry Lee and others. This town's kind of, it's got a lot, these towns have a lot going for them, but and a lot of that has to do with music.
Yeah. So can you settle the argument or the debate around the origin of the name once and for all?
I can't settle anything, but I'll tell you what I've heard. The first one I heard, believe it or not, was if you're looking at a map and you see the Tennessee River and the way it's shaped here in the Lauderdale County area and how it makes a turn toward the northwest, kind of looks like a flex right there, and that bend of the river looks like an arm making a muscle.
Got it. Yeah.
But I'm from Alabama, and I know that there were people diving for mussels back in the day, and somebody just misspelled it.
Just misspelled it. So you, okay.
I'm pretty sure that's what happened.
Makes sense. Sorry.
I mean, I'm probably one of my ancestors, but that's okay.
Yeah, the Nichols family runs deep in Alabama, right?
I think that we are responsible for that. The Nichols family does run deep, and I do think that we should take credit for misspelling Muscle Shoals.
All right.
But all jokes aside, the way I've always viewed it was my first idea of Muscle Shoals with the bend in the river, and then the natives calling this area the Singing River, and then I think that we do kind of put a little bit of muscle into the music around here, a little soul.
Yeah.
It's a different vibe. So I think Muscle Shoals to me just stands for just strong music with a lot of soul.
How early in your life did you realize the music component of the area? I mean, because I think you said your mom at one point, before you were one, gave you a ukulele, right?
Yeah.
As a gift, and you're in a band at six.
Mm-hmm.
So, but obviously music was that part of your family heritage? And how early did you know that, you know, Muscle Shoals was kind of in the DNA here?
Well, it was probably a long time before I realized the weight it carried and what it meant. I just knew that I grew up around people that were playing and singing, playing music and singing songs, my uncle being one of them. And he lived with us when I was really young. And he was singing all the old Muscle Shoals music, from the Walt Aldridge songs to Otis Redding. And then one of his best friends was Travis Womack, who was doing a lot of sessions here, you know, transplant from Memphis. So I just kind of grew up listening to it and sitting in at a young age, playing in bands as a child. And then I don't think it was till I was probably 18 or 19 years old when I really realized how impactful that these men and women I'd spent most of my life with had been in the music industry. And then I was 19 years old and I was a cocky guy. And I just thought, right. You know, it just like, oh yeah, well, I'm one of them. You know what I mean? And that just kind of became my mentality. And I just sunk my teeth into that. Probably in my 30s up until now, when I really have the reverence and the respect for it, and really extreme amount of gratitude for being able to grow up with those people. But it's pretty wild to be born and raised in this stuff.
I met your son earlier. He's young. Do you think he gets it?
That's a good question. I think so. I don't know, though. It's hard to say, because at his age, I mean, again, it was just, I'd been conditioned for this, and okay, this is what you do, and this is, I didn't know anything else. I had not enough separation from it to have the respect. He probably has more respect for it than I did, because he just does overall, you know. He grew up with it so close. I mean, he was in the car seat behind me singing and listening to all the new songs and all the stuff that was coming out. And so he picked up on it a lot quicker than I did.
Yeah. I mean, what an opportunity for him to grow up and with you, you know, as a father and in this area. And I think he's an intern here at the studio, right? So just the by osmosis, and he's in a band, right?
He's a monster.
Yeah.
He's a great guitarist. I mean, I look up to him so much as a songwriter. He sings. He's got the it thing on stage, whatever that is. He got it.
That's awesome.
And he interns here. I mean, he's got a band that he books. He's a whole little entrepreneur. You know?
Yeah, that's right.
And on the dean's list at the college.
Okay.
I was not. So.
It's all right.
Yeah.
That's all right. So real quick, back to Muscle Shoals, I guess what, so I, you know, obviously a lot of people have watched the documentary, you know, about the studios and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I remember in that they make reference to, you know, sort of the mystique and the energy of the river and the dirt having this sort of power and presence that comes through in the music. What is it to you, having grown up here and being born here, and what is it? Why do people flock here to make records? It's kind of weird, right? Because there's a lot of rivers in the country.
Yeah.
You know?
So,
what is it?
I don't know. So, either Rick Hall and Jerry Wexler and the folks got really, really, really lucky, and that law of attraction brought everyone else in. Or, billions of years ago, when this thing took off,
right,
a bunch of stuff stuck together and landed in Muscle Shoals, and it got stuck in the soil and the dirt, the spirit of music and the spirit of honesty and vulnerability landed right here in the river, and then we drink from it. I mean, maybe that's it. I don't know. That's kind of frou-frou sounding, I guess, but for me, what it seems like is David Hood, Jimmy Johnson, Roger Hawkins, and Barry Beckett, and Rick Hall, and Sam Phillips, and Jerry Wexler, and others started something pretty magical. And they were so unselfish with it. Mm. They continued to give it to us, the next generation. And we kept it going. We kept spreading it.
Yeah.
In some towns, everybody wants to keep it to themselves.
Yeah.
Stay out of my sandbox. This is my sandbox. And down here, we share it and give it to the next generation. I also think that's attractive. I think that brings people to town, because we really just want to create art.
Right.
You know? I don't know if that answered your question.
No, it's great. And have you lived in a lot of other places, or has it been mostly here?
Mostly here. I mean, I've traveled so much.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm back and forth between here and Nashville as much. And I used to tell people I'd never move because I knew all the back roads and all the cops. And I still, even after I got to know the cops, the police officers very well in this town, I still chose to stay here because it's just a great community. People love each other. It's a great place to raise a family. The industry's pretty happening here with songwriting and record production. And it's a great place. I suggest if you're looking for a home, by the way,
right,
and you're in the music industry and you feel like, you know, this town or this town or this town is just too hard to get into or be seen or be recognized. If you've got it, bring it to town. We want to hear it.
Yeah, that's good. Good. So what, describe your, how you got involved with Ivy Manor, and what's your role in the group, because it's kind of a diverse team of people, right?
Well, the role changes. I guess I'll start with how I got here, and this is a little bit of a story that may lead into another story. So, you know, I had a long career, started playing music at you know, 5 or 6 years old, professionally, you know, playing for money and whatnot. That led me to a whole other bunch of cool things, including a record deal with Universal Records in Nashville in the early part of 2003 and 4 and 5, 6. Left that label and came back to Muscle Shoals writing songs and producing records, and I got a phone call that a band called the Steel Drivers was looking for a singer. I didn't know much about the band, but once I heard that Chris Stapleton had been the former lead singer and I had written with Chris and had an immense amount of respect for him, I asked Mike Henderson to send me the record. Long story short, I'm in that band for a while, and in 2017, my whole world comes apart. After winning a Grammy, by the way, with the Steel Drivers, I was in the throes of opiate addiction. I was playing doctor. I was in and out of rehab, in and out of jail, and from 2017 until 2021, I didn't do anything except stay high, stay in jail, stay in a hospital, overdose, all the things that go along with that. So when I get out of jail for the last time on June the 2nd of 2021 with a debit card from the Lauderdale County Detention Center with what money I had left, which was $2, which was not even enough to swipe the damn card, and an eviction notice. And a marriage that was completely in shambles, by the way. So I get out, and I'm just trying at this point not to die, right? I'm like, I just don't want to die. And if I stay here, I'm either going to die or I'm going to beat up somebody really bad or something, because our relationship had completely changed. We're still married, but she's got something else going on. I'm a complete addict. So I leave her. I leave that apartment and 2021, excuse me. I sleep in my car for a little while, not getting high. And I don't know. While I was trying to get over that situation, which was my wife with another man, I decided to go what, I don't know if we can say that on this, but I think some of the young kids call it a hoe phase. And I was kind of just in this mode where I was trying to pick my ego up.
Yep.
And anything that shined or shimmered and smiled, you know, I would entertain. And I met this really sweet girl who ended up bringing me over to Ivy Manor. And she was here with her boyfriend, by the way, so we weren't here together, but she brought me over here and I met Michael. And I started hanging out here. And it was really bizarre. Michael knew I'd been to jail and didn't shy away from altercations if needed to be, and he had a guest in the cottage house that he wanted out. So he called me one Sunday because he wasn't here and said, "Hey, I need you to go put this guy out of my house.
Oh my gosh. Won't leave." You did a job for him.
So I came in, called me in for a hit.
Yes.
No, so I came in and politely asked the gentleman to leave, and he did. There was no altercation. It went very well. Couple of weeks later, I was living here. A month after that, I started making my record here, and I came back to life. The early days of my life back off the streets, you know, were started here at Ivy Manor, and I was able to repair a lot of relationships, get a lot of the things back that I lost or pawned or sold or whatever, and that's kind of the long way around how I got here, but that's how I got here.
That's incredible. So, back to the Steel Drivers bit, I think in the reports that, you know, I've tried to review online in terms of, you know, news articles and stuff, they said that you left that band in order to kind of fix yourself, you know, but it doesn't sound like you were fixed, you know, or, you know what I'm saying? Like,
I would have to read the report and see when the timing was.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to go into that for a moment, April of 2017. Now this is after we won the Grammy.
You won the Grammy.
We won the Grammy in February of 2016.
Yeah.
And I was pretty dependent upon the pills at that point, but it was pretty much just pills at the Grammys. Maybe some fentanyl at the time. Fentanyl patches. I wasn't playing doctor. I wasn't administering it to myself other than orally. 2017, I go to rehab the first time and the second time. And then after I got out of rehab the second time, which is when they said I was going away to fix myself. Adam Wakefield, I think, stepped in.
Yeah, that was probably what was they were referring to. Yeah,
and that was the truth. Yeah. The problem is I was going to fix myself because someone said I needed to. I didn't think I had a drug problem.
Interesting, yeah.
And looking back, I didn't have a drug problem. I had a really messed up thinking problem, but I didn't think I had a problem. I still had the job, the cars, the career. Fuck, we just, pardon my French, we just won a Grammy.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was so high on fentanyl when we made that record.
Yeah.
I thought I was just, okay, cool. It's just, so I go to rehab the second time, and when I get out, I get arrested for some paraphernalia that had been in my car before I went to rehab. Didn't even realize it was still in there.
Oh, no.
But it was. I got arrested. That started a whole bunch of mess.
Yeah.
So that was June of 2017 after the first arrest. July 6th, I decided, and I made this decision, to start administering heroin and or fentanyl. Excuse me, it was going to be heroin, not fentanyl, because I was doing the fentanyl patches. And if you know anything about fentanyl, it's 50 times more potent than heroin. So if I just do heroin, I can work my way back, because I'm already doing fentanyl. So now let me just do heroin. Then I'll go from heroin back to pills, and then I'll work the pills back down. I was going to wean myself off. That was absolutely my train of thought. That was what I was thinking. But when I did heroin the first couple of times, and I just snorted it or smoked it, it didn't have the same effect. A, it was weaker than fentanyl, and B, it wasn't doing it. So I decided, I learned at rehab, my second trip to rehab, that I've been wasting my dope. So they told me how to do it. So I did. 6 weeks later, it was all over.
Oh, my gosh.
So
who told you you were doing it wrong?
A 17-year-old kid at Cumberland Heights in Nashville, Tennessee.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, how ironic is that?
Yeah. Well, and it made sense. It made total sense. I mean, anyway, I heard what I wanted to hear.
Yeah.
And so I go home and I start doing that on July the 6th of 2017.
Why do you remember that date?
I remember dates, a lot of dates. But yeah. July 6th of 2007, excuse me, July 6th of 2007, I played the Grand Ole Opry for the first time.
Oh, there you go. That's the connection, yeah.
I could tell you all the dates.
Yeah.
I know my kindergarten girlfriend's phone number.
Wow.
Like, I remember dates and numbers. It's so strange. But that was the date I started shooting.
Wow.
And then 2 weeks later, I was on the road in Pittsburgh with the band. They didn't know this yet. All they had known is I'd gone to rehab and I came back. Tammy looks at me dead ass in the face one morning and says, G-Ray, I don't know what you're doing, but you are playing and singing your ass off.
Oh, jeez.
She had no idea.
Yeah, she was just trying to encourage you.
But I'm just doubled down.
Yeah, yeah. She didn't know it. Yeah.
So I did that. That was like the 20th of July. August the 18th, I was done with the band. Here's the sad thing about that, too. If I'd have made it till December of that year, the house would have been paid off. The credit cards would have been paid off. My car, my wife's car, the daughter's car, the other daughter's car, college set up. I was about to make a lot of money that year. I was homeless January 1st.
So what happened between July and August? Like, why did you leave? Did they kick you out? Did they?
Yeah, so one of the band members went through my stuff.
Oh, my gosh.
Went through my stuff. I was really irritated about that.
Yeah.
I didn't consider the fact that I was a huge liability to this band.
Right.
And they knew something was going on.
Right.
But, yeah, he went through my stuff. And I didn't know that he'd gone through my stuff. But that trip, I remember that trip very well, too, because once I got to Nashville, I drove straight from Nashville to Talladega, Alabama, because this was only like 6 weeks after injecting.
Yeah.
And so I decided I was going to go to detox, because if I didn't get a hold of this right now, I knew what was about to happen. But I'd been to enough 12-step meetings to know where I was headed. But when I got to that rehab, that detox in Talladega, the manager from the band called my wife and said, he's out of the band. Don't call us ever again.
Oh, my gosh.
And so what did I do? Any addict's going to tell you what I did. I got my ass in my truck. I drove back to Florence, and I doubled down again. And at that point, I was just on a mission to die. I wasn't trying to kill myself, but I wasn't trying to hang around either. My only mission every day was to get up, find it, use more and more and more and more and more, and just numb it until it was gone.
How easy was it for you to find?
I had no idea how easy it was to find, but it was 3 blocks from my house. Mm. And so once I lost the house and the cars, actually I stayed in the house for a minute, you know, without power and stuff, because it was close to the dope man. I would just walk, get a bicycle, ride a bicycle. It's pretty sad.
So when they, you know, when they kicked you out, you said you doubled down. Was there no ounce of regret or guilt or anything?
Yeah, which was what fueled the double down.
So that's what triggered that.
So for me, I don't know what it was like for other people, but I learned after going through some paperwork on myself that resentments is really, really bad for me. And I hold huge resentments toward myself every time I do something wrong, which becomes guilt, shame, and remorse. And so when I don't know what to do with that, I don't have an outlet for it, or I haven't learned how to process it or cope with it. Yeah. At that point in my life, I go to what's consistent, which was my substance of choice.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah, I regretted it. I felt terrible about it. Also knew, you have to imagine this, man. I was a father of 4.
Right.
A wife. We had pets. I coached the baseball, the softball, the football. I opened up a recording studio at the local high school and was teaching there. I wasn't doing that while I was injecting. I left that job, thankfully, before it got crazy. But, I mean, I was father of the year and bandmate of the year, so I thought. And then it fell apart. And once I saw that I just ruined all these people's lives and I couldn't correct it right then, I didn't see any way out. I just decided to ride down with the ship. Outlaw. Just roll with it.
So when you were in the middle of that, was it a conscious decision to double down? Like, did you know that you were doing that, or was it just a sort of a flight or fight response? And did you know at the time that, like, you're burning everything around you down, or not until later?
Yeah, so there was this weird thing. No, it wasn't like, okay, I did not say this. The steel drivers fired me, so I'm going to go destroy everything more.
Right.
What happened was the steel drivers fired me, so fuck detox.
Right.
I don't want to be here now. I just went home, and then my wife left again because we weren't living together at this point. We were still kind of together, but then I was just there by myself. And I went to what was comfortable.
Yeah.
And that's where I stayed because I didn't have anybody. I couldn't take care of myself, so I couldn't take care of the kids. Thankfully, they were with her mom and stepfather, their mom and stepfather. Morgan took her kids and went to Birmingham. So I'm just here by myself in the shoals, hiding out from people who cared about me and staying in a dope house.
Wow. So you mentioned the fall, so like July, August, and then by January 1st, you said by December everything would have been paid off, and then by January you basically had lost everything, right? So that is, that's got to be the dark forest for you, right? So like, you know, this podcast, I know you haven't watched the show, but it's inspired by this show called Ted Lasso, and one of the episodes, he coaches a soccer team, and, you know, they're on a losing streak.
Okay.
And he basically is saying, he tells the team in the locker room, fairy tales don't start, nor do they end in the dark forest, right? Mm-hmm. So we're in our dark forest, and he's trying to give them hope, right, to see the blue skies and the sunlight in between the branches. That had to have been your dark forest, right?
I don't know.
I mean, you know, like, and I guess my question is, what was the shimmer of light that you saw after that got you on the path back to, you know, recovery and health and all the good things.
So I always tell people, I truly believe, it's like, oh, you know, Gary hit rock bottom. Every time I hit rock bottom, I had dynamite in my pocket. You know, there's always another bottom, I think, until you're gone.
Hmm.
So what happened for me was, after several trips to rehab and detox and overdoses and jail, I'm now, by the way, looking at prison time for escape. I have an escape charge at a Lauderdale County Detention Center. None of the consequences, it just didn't seem like it could get dark enough. I came home in April of 2021 after 8 months in treatment. I locked myself in my room for 3 days because I was scared to leave. I didn't go to a meeting, didn't talk with anyone, just tried to white knuckle it. And the first place I went was to get a pack of cigarettes 3 days later. And the first person I saw was a dude I used to get high with. And as soon as he asked me, I said, yes. I was on a bender for a few days. I went from meth to heroin to fentanyl within 30 minutes of each other. And 3 days later, I'm dead. Overdosed again in a hospital. This should be another dark forest moment. If there's a place called hell and a place called heaven, I truly believe that I was on my way to hell. I woke up in the hospital, they said, with no pulse. And all I knew was I was walking down a dark tunnel. Somebody was guiding my hand. It was hot. It was chaos. I could hear it. I could smell it. And I woke up in the hospital. That wasn't the dark forest. I went home. I flushed the dope that day. But I kept using until they picked me up and until I went to jail again. So here was what it was for me. The moment, after all the consequences, right, seeing my mama cry, my kids cry, knowing, like, I wanted to quit so bad, Jay. I did not want to do the stuff that I was doing. I was not at all driving. I was not in control.
Yeah.
It's a weird thing. Yeah, it's hard to explain. I even look at people right now who are in the same throes as I, and it's hard to understand why they're doing what they're doing, and you just don't know unless you're in the middle of it. But I'm laying in the Lauderdale County Detention Center, certain I'm going to go to prison. If I don't go to prison, I've already decided I'm going to get a bag of fentanyl and go get myself out of this place so no one has to deal with my bullshit anymore. And if I go to prison, I'll do it and it'll be cheaper because it's all over the prisons, right? That was my mentality. I wasn't going to be here anymore. I was going to unalive myself as quickly as I could get a needle in my hand.
Oh my gosh.
And I don't know, a few weeks in the Lauderdale County Jail, thinking about this every damn day. So my only thought is, what's for supper? Who can I beat out of a game of spades? And I'm going to get a needle in my hand and off myself when I leave this place. That's how I lived.
That was your motivation.
That was my motivation. Jeez. That's how I was doing my time. And I don't know if you've been to jail. Hopefully not. But when you're in jail, sometimes television is very important.
Hmm.
It was movie night. And it was very important. I'm in the cell with a range from murderers to drug traffickers to, tax evasion. I mean, it's we're in, I mean, you know, escape. There's, I mean, maximum security, Lauderdale County Detention Center. And everybody was serious about watching this movie, A Star Is Born, with Lady Gaga.
Oh my gosh.
And
really?
Bradley Cooper.
Seriously.
I'm in jail. Got to do the time. So it's caught time. That's what else am I going to do? So I'm locked into this movie. And I guess somewhere along the way, I started seeing some parallels between Bradley's character and myself. And at the end of this movie, I was so mad and so distraught at this character in this movie. I couldn't sit with it. It had me so upset. And then all the guys are calling their girls. And I don't have one to call at this time.
Hmm.
I go catch my rack and I sit back. I'm leaned back and I swear to you, I hear in a voice very much like I'm talking to myself, are you fucking kidding me? That's how you're going to leave this place. You can have compassion for a character in a movie and you cannot see that as you. Are you fucking kidding me? And immediately I just went, oh shit. Wow. I give up. I surrender. No more 911 prayers, Jay. If you want to send me to prison, send me to prison. If you want to set me on the street, set me on the street. I give up and I don't want to die anymore. Imagine that. Crazy thing is, I went to court a few days later. Now, I was on, by this point, we've skipped some stuff. I was on drug court. I was on a serious deterrent from prison. They were trying to give me one last chance from going to prison for escape. Open plea. Escape one carries 25 to life.
Oh, my gosh.
They had knocked it down to escape three, but I probably at least 15 years. I'm expecting to go to prison when they call me to court, Jay. This is 3 days after I just saw this movie, by the way. I get to court. They call my name. Mr. Nichols, you're going home today. You're on the banana peel program. If you miss one meeting, if you're a dollar short, any mistake, you fail a drug test, you're gone. Yes, sir. Now, I don't know about you.
How do you explain that?
I don't know. And how do you explain that the first thought in my mind was, I want to get high?
Really? Still?
Thankfully, this time it was followed by, no, I don't.
Okay, good.
But everybody that I've told my story to in the room is like, of course that's the first thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I just had a conversation with God and said, I surrender, and I meant it. Jay, I would have passed a lie detector test when I said that. But my first thought was, the disease says, you want to get high, bro. I didn't. I don't know how I didn't get high that day. But I called someone. I got to work pretty immediately. That was my dark forest moment.
So back to the A Star Is Born. So I just want to understand this. So when you were watching it, you were mad at the Bradley Cooper character.
Yeah, I'm,
and then you're also kind of turned it like you're mad at actually having more compassion for him than you do yourself? Or did you not recognize that until later?
I didn't recognize it. I'm just watching the movie as a spectator. And then I sit on my rack after the movie while these guys are calling their loved ones.
Right.
And then my subconscious, the source,
wow,
God, my guardian angel, whatever it was, spoke to me from the 2 o'clock position. Right into my right ear. And I didn't realize it until after the movie. Like, I was so upset at him and then realized.
Got it.
That's me, man.
That's incredible. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, again, the ironic thing is you're in the jail watching this thing and you've got the voice of the angel, you know? Like, you've got the voice of all voices. And just the juxtaposition of, you know, watching an actor play a music star with Lady Gaga, and you're in this jail. I mean, how do you explain the chances of watching that movie in the jail? You know,
I believe in divine intervention. So, I mean, I don't believe in coincidence. I don't know what it is. I still have more questions than I have answers. But I believe that there's something out there. And I don't know why it picks and chooses,
yeah,
how it does, or what, you know, I'm not qualified to say, but I'm hopeful that I was left here because I wouldn't waste my seat.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I still struggle with things.
Yeah.
I'm a human.
Right.
I'm a human, full-blooded North Alabama male that struggles with things every day.
Right.
But I refuse to die with a needle in my arm or a meth pipe in my mouth. Just not going to do it.
Yeah, good for you.
And I believe that if my perspective can be so drastically changed and shifted, and then hopefully I can benefit someone else that would have a shift in their perspective and pay it forward. I'm hoping this thing turns into like the most beautiful multi-level marketing
exactly.
thing ever. Like,
well, seriously.
You know, it's like,
yeah,
life is good when we get out of the way.
Yeah. Well, good for your kids, too. I mean, you know, how much did they know, do you think, that you were in the ditch? You know, could they see it?
Yeah, at one point, they didn't know for a long time. But they knew pretty quickly after, and they were, let's see, this is going to be, they're 15 to 16. They knew.
Yeah.
During that time.
Yeah.
And it was pretty brutal.
Yeah.
I spent my son's 16th birthday in his bedroom. He wasn't there.
Yeah.
The house was already almost gone. Like, they knew Dad was doing something really, really bad. They knew exactly what it was.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you mentioned earlier that you struggle with sort of self-doubt and shame and remorse, and you kind of beat yourself up, right?
Did, for sure.
Yeah. And so, like, now, like, what, so you went through the dark forest for sure. how do you then keep yourself today looking back and feeling like, you know, shit about yourself? Like what's changed in your mindset and healing process to prevent you from going back to the old way?
Well, there's a lot. I'll sum it up like this. Imagine that there's a beautiful white house on the corner of your corner street in your neighborhood, and you drive by it one day and just shoot it up, just AK-47, cannons, muskets, whatever, and set it on fire. And you still live in this neighborhood. I couldn't drive by that house every day knowing that I did that and I left it that way. What keeps me okay today is I'm trying to fix the house, cleaning up the wreckage in my past.
That's good.
I don't pick up new resentments for people very often. And if I do, I try to get rid of it soon so I don't let it affect me. And I do my damnedest not to cause harm to myself or other people on a daily basis. Yeah. And it seems to work.
Good on you, man. That's great. Yeah. It's dramatic and it's sad for a lot of reasons, but it's also inspiring. I mean, I watched you last night do some vocals here on for Davin McCoy, who's, you know, recording the album, and it was something to watch, man. You know, just you, how you approached the whole process, and you were just doing the harmonies, but your voice, I mean, it's something, man.
It's weathered.
Well, no, but that's life, you know. It's the reflection of a life that's, you know, that's been lived.
Well, I'll say this about Davin and the project here at Ivy Manor. First off, there's something magical about this place. It just pulls something out of me. Hmm. Like I can go sing on a corner or go sing at a bar or go sing on stage. And I don't know, I approach things differently from here for sure. I respect it. It's almost hallowed ground.
Yeah.
Also respect Davin and love his writing and his voice and his melodies. So it's a challenge because we sing differently. Right. So I also love that. It's like, okay, now I have to do something I'm not accustomed to. But I loved that last night. Those songs were great, and his project he's making here is going to be unbelievable.
Yeah, no, that's great. So I want to go forward and then come back, even before the Steel Drivers. But so how has your whole time in the Dark Forest impacted the songwriting? And, you know, I think you're planning a new album that's called Learning to Walk Again, right?
Learning How to Walk Again.
Learning How to Walk Again. Obviously, that's a signal to, you know, getting yourself back up and walking like before. How much of that experience now sort of inspires your brain and the songwriting thoughts? Do you have a lot of material now, or is it, you know, from that whole experience?
So during that experience, I was writing a lot of stuff while I was in the throes of it.
Were you really? Yeah.
So all of the record, with the exception of two songs, were written while I was in it.
So the album that's going to be released later this year, is it going to be, it's going to be that music?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
So it was like Devil's Blood, which is, it talks about Devil's Blood. I've lost the house and I'm walking from my mom and dad's house at this point where I'm staying to the dope house, which is now 6 miles away. Walk past through my old neighborhood, the house I just traded for dope, basically. Got high, walked back past that house, went to my mom and dad's house and wrote that song. Most of the songs were probably written at my mom and dad's house, either in the back bedroom or outside on the porch when I was up for 3 or 4 days. But then I wrote... While I was in jail, I started writing Learning How to Walk Again, or it started writing itself. I honestly didn't think I'd ever play again, Jay.
Yeah.
Long before the aha moment with the movie. And I didn't have any instruments. I had one instrument, maybe. I hadn't traded for dope. Who's gonna want to hire me? You know what I mean? Like, right. That's the mindset. And so, but this song kind of kept playing with me. And when I got out and finally made my way to Ivy Manor, I called a friend of mine by the name of Jason Patrick Matthews, wonderful songwriter, and brought him to Muscle Shoals, and we wrote that one. And that was the first song I'd ever written with any kind of sobriety since I was, you know, 14 years old. So that was pretty cool.
That's incredible.
That album. So here's the thing with my music career. I'm in charge of it. I need help, and I'm working on that. So here's what's going on. I'm doing some really fun stuff with RBR Entertainment, RBR Records, which is a bluegrass record label out of Nashville. I've had a couple of singles out, one called This Time Around, which did really well. I believe it held a number one position on one of the bluegrass charts for a little while. Another, and that song was written by Billy Droz, Chris Myers, and Eddie Wilson. And then, no, excuse me, I'm so wrong. The first single was called Fire in the Dark, written by Eddie Wilson, Chris Myers, and Billy Droz. Second single I co-wrote with Terry Hurd and Billy Droz, and it was called This Time Around, which was kind of what this is about. Time around, now that I've lived, I'm going to go out and try to share a positive message of experience, strength of hope, and save someone who's struggling like I was, so maybe they won't hit the same bottom I did. So I'm loving that, the bluegrass thing, touring with Billy Droz and Kentucky Blues some, which is a lot of fun. And then, before I even got back to Bluegrass Radio, I already had this record I was making at Ivy Manor Music Group with Dan Hannon and Michael Wright and Jared Prashevich. And it's all the struggle songs. Yeah. It's more of the Americana format. I mean, there's some drums and steel guitar, or electric guitar, not steel guitar, but organ and keys and that kind of stuff. So it's a lot different from the bluegrass thing. I'm hoping it will be out in the fall of 24.
Nice.
And I will know more about that probably by the time this podcast comes out.
Okay.
So, but yeah, there's a lot going on. There's bluegrass stuff. There's Americana stuff. I'm songwriting. And yes, I think to answer your question about how it's affected me, I tend to find the younger people that are coming to write with me these days are wanting to write that.
Mm.
The hard stuff,
yeah,
which I love.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, it's not all about your hot getting my truck.
Right.
Let me rock on and show you how country I am. It's they want to write something with some substance.
Yeah.
So I love that, but also still write songs about heartbreak and heartache because I've gone through that as much as anything.
Right.
Whether it be because of the substance or the girl.
Right. You know? Right. Well, so that's a good segue to go back, because I want to talk about like the 2006 to 2010 time. Just real briefly, and then we can wrap it up. So I think one of your hits when you were a single artist before the Steel Drivers was I Can't Love You Anymore. And to me, you know, in reading the lyrics and listening to it, it's a tremendous heartbreak song.
Yeah, it was written by James Otto and John Rich.
I guess, what was the genesis of that? And did you record it having gone through a breakup, heartbreak, whatever?
I was happily married when I recorded it to my first wife. But I've gone through a lot of heartbreak, probably mostly self-inflicted.
Right.
Like I fall in love, or I used to fall in love really hard and really fast. And when I heard that song, it was more of a business move.
Oh, okay.
It
sounded
like a smash
to
me.
Yeah, it sounded like a hit, yeah.
I love James Otto and John Rich. We were doing some work together at the time, writing some songs and whatnot. And I just love the song. But that song has absolutely haunted me since then, much like some of the songs that I write, they later come true. And my problem is I've loved very much a lot of wonderful women.
Right.
I'm not saying a lot, like I'm trying to be gross, Will Chamberlain, but I've had a...
No, I get you.
You know what I mean?
No, like, I get it, yeah.
I love, every time I sing that song, it kind of takes me to a place, and there's one that I always sing it to. So, she just doesn't know.
Hmm. So, does it haunt you because of sort of missed opportunities?
No, I think it was the perfect opportunity. I think sometimes I feel like my lot in life may be to receive and to release and to document it.
Okay.
Like, I'm okay with, I don't mind heartbreak. Like, it gives me something that inspires me. It motivates me to do something different.
Yeah.
I try not to fall in love anymore, you know. It's, so far I've battling, but I'm doing okay. but yeah, it's I don't know. Does that make any sense at all to an Earth? I'm going to call you an Earth person, but like to say out loud, I'm okay with experiencing all the phases of love.
Yeah, no, I think, yeah.
And
that makes sense.
And documenting it for y'all.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense.
And then each new person kind of gives you a new take, a new experience. Yeah. And you're older and you have a little different perspective on it. I don't know.
Yeah,
I haven't really said that out loud, but that's kind of how I feel.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense a lot. Well, so, you know, I was married a long time, and the song resonated with me because it talks about, you know, leaning into the pain.
Mm-hmm.
I think it uses different words, but and that's what I think, you know, after a breakup or after a relationship ends, it's one thing to just try to forget it, but you feel something and it's better to experience it and
for
to
sure.
get through it, right? Rather than compartmentalize it or rather than, you know, just kind of like, you know, brush it to the side.
Here's what happens when you run from it. And if you think of it in the sense of a storm like that, if you're running from it, it's constantly chasing you.
Yeah.
If you hit it head on, that's why I love sad songs make me smile. I always say that. When I'm going through that, I want to hear that. I want to write that. I go right through it. It's coming at me head on, and I'm going at it head on, just like you said, leaning straight into it. And then we pass.
Yeah.
And at some point, toward the end of the storm, it starts to be okay. Yeah, definitely go through it. If you're going through a heartbreak right now, just get on Spotify and just find a heartbreak playlist, or just type in Gary Nichols. You'll probably find right. some songs.
That's right.
And just get through it. It'll be okay.
Well, so here are the lyrics, and you know, and it's a great song, but it's called "I Can't Love You Anymore." So it's, how do I break it to my heart that it's got to get over you? How do I learn to live apart from the one I gave my life to? Well, right here, right now, let it turn me inside out so I can just move on. So bring on the pain, let it kill your memory. Bring on the rain, let it drown what's left of you and me.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's pretty good, right?
It is pretty good, man. And it's, I mean, when you say that, you mean it. Just bring it on.
Yeah.
Hit me with it. I'm not running from it. I know you're leaving. I know it's over. This phase of our life is over. Okay, let me process it.
Yeah.
Because if you're like me and you don't process it and you run from it and then you start to find something else to fill its void, then you're just sitting there with the same problem and you've got something else on top of it, you know?
Yeah.
You know, if you take alcohol away from an alcoholic, broken-hearted man, you still got a broken-hearted man.
Hmm.
So you still got to fix the broken heart.
Yeah.
Get through it.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned it's funny that you used a term earlier called, you know, hoe phase, right? So I think that applies to, you know, men and women, you know, after a long relationship,
sure.
Right? So, and I'm not saying that I necessarily went through a hoe phase, but
you should.
I was,
not.
I was, you know, I was married a long time. I married basically the first person I fell in love with, and I was scared to death, right, to go out but I wanted to meet new people, and a lot of people were like, Jason, like, why are you trying, like, why are you going on so many first dates, and why are you leaning into this so much? And it's like, I wanted to have the experiences, right?
Mm-hmm.
In my day job, I've been in sales a long time, you know, selling like technology services. And in sales, you have to be able to withstand and accept the no, you know, because you get your heart broken all the time in sales, you know.
Yes.
So it's like, so my whole approach was, I'm going to meet, you know, good people, you know, try to meet good people and just see where it goes and lean into it, knowing that it could get rough.
Right.
But I think that's life, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, and people are like, why are you being so vulnerable? And why are you putting yourself out there? It's like, what else would I, what else would I want to do? You know, I want to I'm almost 50. I'll be 50, you know, probably by the time this is recorded or published. And, you know, my eye is open now to like the fact that I've got less than half my life left. I'm going to go live it. You know?
Yeah. That's kind of where I am too. Like, well, my relationship situation is touchy because I've been married twice to two wonderful women.
Yeah.
And I'm the common denominator. period. So now the common denominator after, like, I've all the money I had went up my arm, right? So now I'm starting over. I've done pretty well in the past few years.
Right.
Got a house, got cars, doing this sort of thing, making amends, all that sort of stuff. But like, A, I don't have my house in order to bring someone else and be able to feel like my duty to provide for or provide with in today's society, whatever you want to call it. I'm just not there yet. Also, was married collectively for 20 years. I'm the common denominator. That's okay. But as a whole number right now, I'm just going to be very, very selective about when I decide to do that. Problem is, like you said, we're getting, you know, I've lived 16,700 something days, bro.
Right.
You know, I don't know how many of them are left, but I'm not just going to selfishly say, well, I don't want to die alone, so I'm going to lock you down.
Right.
I'm just, when that time comes, it comes.
Well, it's probably hard for you too, as an incredible musician. I mean, I'm sure you've got options, you know?
Well,
and you said earlier, you're going to be selective, but I'm sure that's got to be tough.
Well, you know, we all have options, right? Here's what's really tough is when you have someone in your life that probably treats you better than anyone's ever treated you and loves you so well, and you don't understand it because you've not been in that type of relationship. And you're like me right now. You don't want it.
Right. And it's like, why not? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got... there's a, love her to death. She's a dear friend of mine. I'm not going to call her name on here. Yeah. But she knows who she is.
Yeah.
And I ask myself, you know, daily, what the hell am I doing? But what I'm doing is sticking to the plan that I said I was going to do when I came out
to
the side, and just trying to stick to the mission. And then I ask myself, well, could she help me achieve the mission? You know what I mean? Like, she's that kind of, she's that kind of woman.
No, that's great. Well, so, not everybody has the opportunity to replace somebody like Chris Stapleton in a band, right? So I guess, could you just share how that all came about and how, you know, were you excited? Were you scared? Were you intimidated by that, you know?
No.
I mean, obviously he wasn't really, I mean, he was always Chris Stapleton, but he's taken on a huge persona now, but even at the time, you know...
First off, let me start by saying I absolutely love, admire, respect, and adore Chris and all of his workings. But if I were a boxer, I'd go in the ring with Tyson.
Yeah, I can see that.
Or Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, I can see that.
I'm just, you know what I mean? I ain't scared of shit.
Yeah, I can see that.
And he's a monster.
Yeah.
So, but when I got the call... No, I was like, well, I don't want to be in a band.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I'm a solo artist.
Yeah.
In a bluegrass band. And then Mike Henderson said, yeah. I said, well, who's the singer? He said, Stapleton. I said, oh, well, send me the record, because, I love bluegrass.
Right.
But if you've heard me sing, you don't think
right
off the bat, oh, that's a bluegrass singer from East Kentucky. So I was never thought about being in a bluegrass band. But when I heard that first record, good night, man. Good Corn Liquor. That I was sold right then.
Yeah.
So then I probably got excited because it was just fun stuff to play. But when I joined the band, it was just like me reverting back to being a cover guy. That's what I felt like. Like, I've done the cover band for a while. I love all these songs, though, so I'll sing all these songs. And then we got to making our first record, Hammered Down. That's the first time I felt pressure.
Mm.
Only because... And it wasn't intentional, but the people kept bringing up the fact that they had been nominated for a Grammy for Where Rainbows Never Die.
Right.
I was like, oh, shit. You know, Chris is not yet really taken off just yet. I think at this time he's still doing the Johnson Brothers. But I still felt a little bit of pressure at that point in time. By the time the Muscle Shoals recordings got here, I don't think I felt anything. And so I just went in just completely untapped, unhinged, George Dickel, fentanyl, whatever else, probably plenty of other things too, but and just wasn't scared at all. and just went and made the record. And I'll say this because I don't know that it gets said a lot, but you know, Jimmy Nutt and myself with the band cut those tracks, and then Jimmy Nutt and I spent a lot of time on that record, like producing that record. I think Jimmy should get, I don't know if he's got production credit or not. I think he just might have gotten engineer credit.
Okay.
But Jimmy Nutt and myself produced that record with Jason doing two songs, Isbell. And it was just one of those things where it was, I was left in my home studio with a buzz, just having fun.
Jeez.
Just having fun.
Jeez.
And it worked.
Yeah. Well, you may not have recognized it at the time because you were probably numb and, you know, in a different state of mind, but how gratifying is it now to look back saying that you won a Grammy recorded here at the Nut House in Muscle Shoals called the Muscle Shoals Recordings? I mean, that's pretty cool, right?
Way cool. Yeah, it's way cool, man. I don't think about it too often. I think sometimes I give myself almost want to take it away from myself sometimes because I feel like I didn't deserve it. You know what I mean? I have those days. But then when I live in the program and I realize that we don't have to regret our past nor wish to close the door on it, then I'm really grateful for it and I'm proud of it. I'm never doing it for the awards or the accolades. I mean, I write music because it makes me feel, and I want to make other people feel something. That's the only reason I do it. And so the awards are nice, man. They really are, but... so is it when someone comes up to you and says, hey, man, you know, I'm 127 days down needle in my arm and learning how to walk again really helps, man, every day. That's the award. That's the reward, man.
That's great. That's great. Well, last question, and I really appreciate your time.
Yeah.
So at this point in your life, you know, what are you most curious about?
Doja Cat.
Okay.
So curious.
You're a cat person too.
I'm a cat person. I'm just teasing. I do have a small crush on Doja Cat.
All right.
Man, what am I most curious about? I'm a curious cat. I'm curious about a lot of things. Most curious about right now, whether it's going to be an asteroid, a comet, or the sun on April the 8th.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
I've been watching the stuff. You seen any of this stuff on TikTok? Yeah. Like, I'm curious. Like, I don't know. I'm not out there watching what's happening. I can't say for sure.
Right.
There are options. I mean, it could be Halley's Comet or whatever it's called. It's coming. Like, so that's probably what I'm most curious about right this moment.
Okay.
And Doja Cat.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Gary. Would you play us some music?
Absolutely. Let me tune my guitar.
All right. Thanks, Gary.
All right, Jay. So this is a song I wrote about what it felt like coming out of all that struggle. You know, it doesn't matter what your struggle is. It could be like mine with drugs or alcoholism. You know, or whatever your struggle may be. Sometimes you just have to start over and reboot and relearn things, and that's kind of what this is about. It's called Learning How to Walk Again. 1, 2, 3. Learning how to walk again. I ain't that steady yet. Like a baby, I'm just taking my first steps. Oh, and I might fall while I'm trying to stand. Learning how to walk again. Learning how to love myself in spite of how I've been my worst enemy. Now I'm trying to be my own best friend. It'll be worth it all if I can help someone else. Learning how to love myself. I'll look back at all the struggles I've been through. See
silver lining shining out of all that blue. I'll be more of who I am, less of who I was way back when. But until then, I'm learning how to talk again, how to just say no. For the longest time was a word that I just didn't know what it meant, all the pain it could prevent. I'm learning how to talk again. Someday I'll look back at all the struggles I've been through, see the silver lining shining out of all that blue. I'll be more who I am, less of who I was way back when. But until then, I'm learning how to walk again. I'm getting stronger every day. This new path don't lead back to my old ways. No, I ain't there yet, but I'm on the mend, learning how to walk again. I know I ain't there yet, but I'm on the mend, learning how to walk again.
This is the song I wrote. I was, I just lost the house or gave it away and left on about a 6 mile hike from my mom's house to the dope man's house, which was about 3 blocks away from where I used to live. So I walked past the house, past the living room window, and my son's bedroom window is right there on the front in the corner, and like we weren't there, nothing was left. I go get the stuff and got high, and I walked right back past the place on my way to my mom's, and I guess I started writing the song then, but this one just kind of fell out in about 20 minutes at my mom's kitchen table. It's called The Devil's Blood. And if you don't know what The Devil's Blood is, I pray you never find out. Walking through the city, hungry, homeless, dirty, and dope sick. My hat and clothes are dingy, and the dirt under my nails is 9 days thick. I'm just trying to find some paper and a ride across the river once again. I know the man that's got it, the ink that I've been needing for my pen. It's brown and a little bitter when you heat it up with water in a spoon. Pull it up through the cotton, tie off and find a line to put it through. Then you draw till you see red, push the plunger down, and then you're through. Fall back and feel the feeling of the devil's blood bleeding into you. My old house was just off Chisholm, a couple blocks behind the Baptist church. Some days I walk by and remember what my life was like when I was hurt. Back before I shot it all,
down to the beds we all were sleeping in. I had to move back home with mama, 39 hooked on heroin. It's brown and a little bitter when you heat it up with water in a spoon. Pull it up through the cotton, tie off and find a vein to push it through. Then you draw till you see red, push the plunger down and then you're through. Fall back and feel the feeling of the devil's blood bleeding into you. I hope you never feel the feeling of the devil's blood bleeding into you.
Thanks so much for joining us for another episode of Curious Goldfish. Please follow and subscribe to the podcast and on social media. Also, tell your music-loving friends about us too. Until next time, stay curious.